Once Sridhar Maharaj is told that Srila Prabhupada has written Bhagavad Gita as it is, and so that he could publish, Sridhar Maharaj wanted to publish his Gita, so that competing with Srila Prabhupada, he didn't want to compete. He titled his Bhagavad Gita, The Hidden Meaning of the Bhagavad Gita, Hidden Treasure. So here is the title of this chapter, the subjective Bhagavad Gita. Not the objective, not as it is, but what is underneath that outer, the objective part. What is underneath, what is the hidden meaning of the Bhagavad Gita? In other words, what he means here, subjective Bhagavad Gita. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Dinamane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sunivari Paschacha Desatarane Om Agyanati Mirandasya Dinanjana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. And I wanted to say one prayer for protection for Vishwajit Prabhu, who is not feeling well these days. And we'll say one prayer to Lord Nisringadeva for his protection. Namaste Narasringaya Prahladaladadayane Hiranyakashipurvakshaha Silatam Kalnakalaye Ito Nisringo Paratho Nisringo Shringamadim Saranam Prapade Tavakara Kamalavare Nakam Madbhuta Shringadev. So the subjective Bhagavad Gita. Both Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladev Vidyabhushan have commented on Bhagavad Gita, and Jiva Goswami has also given his explanation of different verses. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given his own explanation, and he has included both Baladev and Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentaries in his Bengali translation of Bhagavad Gita. Sridhar Swami's commentary was the original one, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had great appreciation for his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. I have attempted to shed some new light on some verses in Bhagavad Gita. On the basis of what the previous commentators have said, I have shown the further development of Madhurya Rasa in Bhagavad Gita and even the paramour relationship of Parakya Rasa. When I discussed my explanation with Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, I asked him, in this place in Bhagavad Gita, I have given my interpretation to include Madhurya Rasa. What do you think? He told me, what more can be said? Your interpretation is perfectly correct. Still, it was a new conception I had given there. I found Parakriya, the paramour devotion of the gopis for Krishna, represented in the verse, Tesham Satata Yuktanam Enamam Upayantite. Just as Srimad Bhagavatam has four essential verses, there are four essential verses in the Bhagavad Gita, which contain the very gist, the very substance of the whole ontological conception of Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita 8.10.8, the first of the four nutshell verses is as follows. Aham sarvasya prabhu matak sarvam pravartate iti madhva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. I am the origin of everything. Everything emanates from me, including all conceptions of the absolute truth and even my own worship. The wise who know this fully worship me with bhava, deep devotional ecstasy. Here, Krishna says, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate. Everything emanates from me, including all conceptions of the absolute truth. In Bhagavatam, the three main conceptions of the absolute are given, Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. Brahman means the all-comprehensive aspect of the absolute. Paramatma means the all-permeating aspect of the absolute. And Bhagavan means the personal conception of the Absolute. In his Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami has given the real meaning of Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. The general meaning of Bhagavan is one who commands all sorts of potencies. All sorts of potencies are controlled by him personally. That is the conception of Bhagavan found in Narayana Vaikuntha. But Jiva Goswami has given a particularly fine interpretation of Bhagavan. He says that Bhagavan means Bhajaniya Sarva Sadguna Avashishta. The nature of Bhagavan is such that whatever comes in contact with him feels a natural serving tendency towards his charming personality. He is endowed with such qualities that everyone is drawn to worship him and to love him. He attracts the love of everyone. Everyone wants to serve him, and this is Bhagavan. He is endowed with qualities that attract everyone to serve him. I have included this special interpretation of Jiva Goswami in my commentary on the above Bhagavad Gita verse. In Srimad Bhagavatam, three phases of the Absolute have been described: all-comprehensive Brahman, all-pervading Paramatman, an all-attractive absolute person, Bhagavan. I have explained in my commentary that Krishna's statement here, Aham Sarvasya Prabhuvo, means I am Swayam Bhagavan, the original personality of Godhead. I am at the root of all these three conceptions of the absolute, and I am the origin not only of Brahman, the all-comprehensive absolute, and Paramatman, the all-pervading absolute, all-permeating absolute, but also of Narayan, the master of all potency, who commands the respect of everyone. I am the origin of all of them. I am, so I am Bhagavan. This way, I have interpreted the meaning of Aham Sarvasya Prabhu. And in the next line, when Krishna says, Matak Sarvam Pavartante, here we must concentrate more finely. Krishna says, Sarvam Pavartate, everything comes from me. With this, Krishna is saying, even the worship of me comes from me. I reveal it first. I myself worship myself. And I do this as Guru, as my finer potency. This potency is nothing but myself, and my finest potency is Radharani. Through my potency, I worship myself. Every movement begins from me. Even my own worship, my own service, is begun by me in my role as Guru. I reveal that to the public so that you will properly worship me. For this reason, Guru is called Bhagavan, or Bhagavat, for he is non-different from me. Acharyamam Vijaniyam. The finest potency of Bhagavan is Radharani. So Guru, in the highest sense, as well as service in the highest sense, is represented in Srimati Radharani. Next, Krishna says, those who know this will worship me. Iti madhva bhajanti mam. Those who understand this conception that Radharani serves him in the highest way, will serve Krishna in subjugation to her. That is Radha Dasyam, the divine service of Sri Radha, and it is with this understanding that a worshiper will come to worship Krishna. In my interpretation, I have taken it that this is Krishna's intent when he says, Iti Madhva Bhajanti Mam. Knowing this, they worship me. He means those who know that my worship comes from me and that my finest potency worships me best will worship me under the direction of my finest potency. Here we find the importance of Radha Dasyam, the service of Sri Radha, the highest goal of the followers of Rupa Goswami, the Rupanuga, Gaudiya Sampradaya. Here, Krishna is saying, knowing that it is my finest potency that worships me best, one will worship me under the direction of my first-class worshiper, Sri Radha. With this idea, one will always worship me under the guidance of my finest Shakti, Srimati Radharani, or her representation, Sri Gurudev. In this way, they will always worship me under their direction and never as a direct worshiper. And this is the meaning of Iti Madhva Bhajanti Mam. Then Krishna says, Buddha Bhava Samanvita. Here, Buddha means those of fine theistic intellect, Sumedasha. In Bhagavatam, it is said that those of the fine theistic intellect will be able to appreciate this Yajantihi Sumedasha. Fine theistic intelligence is the outcome of good fortune which comes from above Sukriti. It is not self-acquired. That fine intellectual inner direction and guidance can only come from the Nirgun or transcendental plane. Buddha here means one who has a direct connection with the Nirgun or transcendental plane. His intelligence doesn't come from this Maya quarter. Rather, it springs from the spiritual platform. Only such a person can appreciate these subtle points. This is said in Bhagavatam. Krishna Varnam Srita Krishnam Sangopanga Straparsadam Yagyaik Sankirtana Prayarya Chantihi Sumedasha. Those who are fine theistic intellect, Sumedasha, will worship Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Sankirtan, not others. So this verse from Bhagavad Gita means one whose devotion is the product of the Nirgun wave, whose faith is not collected from this world of misunderstanding, shall worship me through Radha Dasyam. Here Bhava Samanvita means Raga Samanvita. That is, they worship Krishna with Anurag or love. Their affinity for Krishna, their devotion to him, is not governed by rules. It does not spring from strictly following the scriptural rules, but from bhava, inner inspiration. This worship is called Ragamarg, the path of spontaneous attraction. Scriptural rules involve calculations of loss and gain, but worship, which is bhava samanvita, is not drawn from any consideration of loss and gain. It flows naturally through love and attraction for Krishna. It is gyan shunyabhakti. Free from calculation, free from profit and loss, jnana karma dhyanavritam, means it is free from jnana and karma. The next of the four essential verses which contain the entire message of Bhagavad Gita is as follows. By the way, we should stop here and ask, are there any questions about what I just read? Everyone follow? About the first verse. Aham sarvasya pavavo matak sarvam pavartate imadvabhajanti mambhuta bhava samanvita. That's the first of the Chatur Sloki, the first of the four essential verses of the Bhagavad Gita. And Sridhar Maharaj has given his commentary on that. What is the meaning of that? Was anyone able to follow?
No, Maharaji.
No. Difficult, huh?
Yes, Maharaji.
Akshay Prabhu?
Yes, Maharaj.
Was it difficult to follow what he was saying there? Little?
It's a decide. It looks simple from. But maybe it's a very deep. I was saying it's. It looks simple, but maybe it's very deep.
He's saying basically, Krishna is saying everything comes from me. He's telling everything comes from me. And whatever that means, even the worship of Krishna is coming from him. Everything means everything. Sometimes we think, oh, I have so much love for Krishna. No, we don't have anything. If I have love for Krishna, then it's coming from Krishna. It's his mercy. And whatever service I'm doing for him, that is also coming from him. Whatever inspiration I have for serving him, that is also coming. Now, how does that come, though? How is he arranging, how is he producing the service in us for himself? That's the thing. How is that? How is he doing that? And you can say everything is coming from me. Even all these devotional activities are coming. But how does he do it? What is the details? Then further explanation is given. Even Acharya Manvijaniyat, even Guru, and that's like Prabhupada used to tell us, Yasya Prasada Bhagavat Prasada, by the mercy of Krishna, the Guru comes, and by the mercy of Guru, one gets Krishna, one can serve Krishna. So Guru is to be understood as the means by which Krishna engages us in his own service, in other words, through his devotee. And in the highest sense, the devotee of Krishna, the highest devotee of Krishna is Srimati Radharani. She is the best servitor of Krishna, the highest servitor. And so when one can see Guru in that position as the representative of Srimati Radharani, then has the best servitor of Krishna, then through the service of the servitor of Krishna, we can hope to please Krishna. Radharani is the best servitor, means she can knows how to please Krishna the most. We should not think that I can serve Krishna better than Srimati Radharani, not possible. Rather, Radharani is the manifestation of Krishna's own potency that gives pleasure to him. Highest pleasure to him, that manifestation of the kind of service that gives the highest pleasure to him is called Srimati Radharani. So no one else can compete with that, because that is Krishna's own potency. Then if we also expecting to please Krishna, then it has to come in that line under Srimati Radharani's auspices. And that is also by the arrangement of the Lord's pleasure potency, internal potency, coming from Srimati Radharani. And it comes down to us. A very intricate understanding Srila Mars has given here of this verse. Why? That's why he is calling this the hidden treasure. It takes a little contemplation, little thing, thoughtfulness, to try to understand what is the meaning of these verses in the deeper level. And Srila Maharaj told that he consulted one day with Srila Prabhupada here. I have written this interpretation. What do you think? And Prabhupada said, yes, this is very nice. I can't mean anything different from what you have said. It must mean that. And after, when discussing these Chatur Shloki verses with Srila Prabhupada, when Prabhupada told us, he said, if you heard what he said, you would faint. If you heard his explanations, it would cause you to faint. There's such high explanations he has given of these things. Srila Maharaj was known for that, and giving very deep conceptions, ontological conceptions. Anyhow, in the Bhagavad Gita, there are these four verses. They are considered the core of the whole Bhagavad Gita, as given in these verses, beginning with the Hamsarvasya Prabhu. In the 10th 10th chapter. Now, that means Chatur Sloki means four verses. So the first one was Aham Sarvasya Prabhu. Now we're reading the next one, the second verse, and that's 10 of those four. And this, that first one was 10:8, and this one is 10:9. So it says as follows. Machchita madgita prana purayanta parasparam katayanta shamam nityam dushyanti cha ramanti cha. The hearts and minds of my devotees are always filled with me, and they are forever experiencing pleasures and ecstasy and talking about me. Oh, Avadhut Rai Prabhu, I did not ask you. Are you following everything? Are you there? Huh?
Yes, I'm here. Yes.
Okay. Purushottam wants to join? Purushottam is online?
He's online, Maharaji. His connection is bad.
Huh? Connection not good?
Yes, Maharaji. He's online. Haribol Purushottam Prabhuji. No, Maharaji, it's still ringing. I'm trying for him, Maharaji. Like, he's got a bad connection. He's online, offline.
Oh. I see. I just got a message from him from Friday. I see. Are you there, Purushottam?
I just dropped him, Maharaj. I'm calling him again.
Because
he's not picking up the phone. I don't know why. It's not. He went offline.
He went off. Went offline again. Unfortunately. Is a problem. Huh? All right, anyhow, the hearts and minds of my devotees are always filled with me, and they are forever experiencing pleasure and ecstasy and talking about me. The second of the Chatur Shlokas. Then, here Krishna says, I am in their hearts, in their thinking, much chitta and madgata prana. Prana means like the, you know, the like when you hear a pranayam, means the breath, or the life. Life is considered in the pran. And the chitta. Chitta means like the mind, the thoughts. Much chitta, I am in their minds and I am in their life. I'm in their whole life. So I'm in their hearts and their thinking. Their whole life, their entire energy is spent for me, utilized for me. You are there, Purushottam?
Yes, Maharaj. I just got connected.
Okay. You know where we're at?
No, Maharaj.
We're on page 155. Do you have the link?
No, Maharaj.
Okay, let's see.
I'm sending it, Maharaj. You can send it.
I got it. And page 155. If you type 155 in the search box, you'll get to the page where we're at. We're discussing the second of the Chatur Shloki of the Bhagavad Gita. Machchita madgata prana bodayanti parasparam katayantas chamam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha. That verse. And Srila Maharaj is giving his commentary on that. Translation is, the hearts and minds of my devotees are always filled with me, and they are forever experiencing pleasure and ecstasy and talking about me. And here Krishna says, I am in their hearts, in their thinking, their whole life, their entire energy is spent for me, utilized for me. Their prana shakti, their life energy, is also fully devoted for my cause. Internally, they are always thinking about me and devoting their whole energy for me. And externally, they talk about me to enhance their mutual understanding in the meaning of bodhayanta parasparam. They love to talk about me with one another. They talk about nothing else. In private life and in public life also, they love to talk about me and nothing else. I am the only subject of the discussions. Katayantas cha mam nityam. Whatever they do, wherever they are, everywhere, I am the subject of their talks. And next, Krishna says, in this they find great satisfaction, tushyanti cha ramanti cha. The internal meaning of tushyanti cha ramanti cha is as follows. Here, two levels of devotees are described. Up to vatsalya rasa, or the parental mellow of devotion, Krishna's devotees are feeling great satisfaction, tushyanti. But above this is the higher kind of satisfaction, ramanti, experience in the Madhurya rasa. This Ramanti, just like we hear Ram when we're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. That Ram is also called Ramanti. Some people think Ram means Balaram or Ramachandra. But actually, Ram in that mantra is the pleasure potency, Ramanti, the pleasure potency of the Lord, Hare Ram, a higher understanding of that Maha Mantra, and that is experienced in the Madhurya Rasa. Just as a wife and husband enjoy a particular kind of connection, Krishna's devotees feel ecstasy, Ramanti, in his connection, simply by talking about him. Here the Acharyas have agreed that the word Ramanti indicates concerthood, and that devotees in concerthood can experience the very deep connection of husband and wife in relation to Krishna. This is also, we should remark here, that in the material world, this conjugal relationship, sexual relationship, is a pleasurable experience. But the pleasure of the spiritual world, the higher pleasure of conjugal relationship can also be experienced by your mouth, by talking. Talking and sexual engagement, they are non-different in the absolute world. Devotee does not feel any lack of enjoyment, conjugal enjoyment, from the spiritual platform. He doesn't have to engage in any sex life in order to enjoy the highest pleasure of simply that is coming from talking about Krishna. Their connection is at that the higher sphere. The absolute sphere, the transcendental sphere. I'm simply talking, one can experience the highest pleasure that in this world has to be done only through coitus, through a relation of a sexual relationship. Whatever pleasure is in that, devotees can experience that simply by talking, simply by taking prasad, simply by thinking of Krishna. The physical activity is unnecessary. Only in this sphere, the physical activity can't be substituted by any other activity. But in the higher sphere, absolute plane, all activities are interchangeable. So in the company of Krishna, they feel the ecstasy of concerthood, Ramanti Cha. They also feel that ecstasy even when they are only talking about Krishna. This meaning of the word Ramanti has been explained in different places by Vishwanath, Baladeva, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and also admitted even by Shankaracharya, who agrees that the word Ramanti indicates concerthood. So, then, this is the next verse. Anyhow, the specialty of that second verse of the Chatur Sloki is this meaning of the word Ramanti. Tushyanti Ramanti. Tushyanti is the pleasure that they feel of ordinary pleasure that is coming from chanting about Krishna, talking about Krishna, and then Ramanti. This more intimate kind of relationship is also there, simply in the talking, according to the advancement of the devotee, and according to his intensity of his relationship with Krishna. You can feel the different levels of ecstasy in just talking about Krishna. Yesterday or the day before yesterday, Vishwajit Prabhu was asking me, he said, how do you know when you're advancing in Krishna consciousness? What should we look for? So we know we're advancing in Krishna consciousness. Thinking that how do we know when we're trying to go to the infinite plane? What is infinite? What is inconceivable? How can we know we're making any progress in that world? That is a very difficult thing, actually. The symptom of progress in that plane is that we feel we're not making any progress. We feel we have no possibility, no hope of getting there. Srila Maharaj used to tell that as soon as you think you have some grasp of that world, you don't have it, because we are finite. And whatever grasp, whatever foothold we think we can have in that world, then that is illusory. We have reduced it down to our finite experience. Then that is not the infinite. If we have some claim to that world, and we are finite, and that is infinite, and we think we have some claim to that, then whatever claim we have put over that world, that is only finite, is not the infinite. So the real measure of who is in touch with the finite is he feels, I have no touch of that. I can't possibly grasp that. That is completely beyond my capacity. And then that person is to have be understood as having some appreciation of what is infinite. Anyhow, so that part, making progress in that world will have to be in a negative sense. Then another way of understanding our advancement, however, is how much we are becoming detached from this material platform, not engaging in mundane activities. That is a more tangible, positive kind of indicator. So devotee who gets this complete satisfaction of talking about Krishna, the higher pleasure or manticha of talking about Krishna, who can get some irresistible joy in that activity, then automatically gives up all this desire for sexual enjoyment, for sensual enjoyment is automatically decreased, because he's getting pleasure from the transcendental platform. Not that he is missing any pleasurable experiences, but the pleasurable experiences of this world are like garbage compared to the pleasures of that world, the absolute world. And only by thinking, simply by thinking about that world, then everything is there. There is no lack or diminution of the joy. Simply by thinking, remembering Krishna, smaranam, or kirtanam, chanting, or shravanam, hearing, any of those. Archanam, doing the worship in the temple. Materialistic persons, when they see the devotees doing those things, they think, what is that? What are they doing? Wasting their lives, chasing after sky flowers. Hours of the sky. Nothing tangible in that. Why don't you go out, get a good job, get a wife, have a family, then do something useful for this world? And they think like that. And those things will give pleasure. What you are doing, how you can get any satisfaction in that. So it's inconceivable to the mundane person how a devotee is getting everything and more than what the materialist is getting. Anyhow, the next verse. Any questions before we go on? All right. Then the next verse, Bhagavad Gita 10:10. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite. To those who constantly worship me with devotion, I give the intelligence by which they can come to me. So this is the ordinary meaning of the verse. But there is a deep meaning also. Here Krishna says, those persons who are continuously engaged in me without interruption, satata yuktanam, satatam. Sat means eternal, yukta, joined. So satata yuktanam, those who are eternally joined, that means without interruption. Satata yuktanam, who are always in me, who are connected with me, who serve me with great love and respect within their heart. Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam. I inspire them with the intelligence by which they will come to me. They will come to me in closer connection, but I found that this is redundant. Krishna has already said Satata Yuktanam. Their devotion is continuous. They are always there in my connection. If they are already in connection with Krishna, then we must ask, why would again say they will come to me? Krishna has already said that these devotees talk only of him, think only of him, take pleasure in him, and are always engaged in his service. He says they are always connected with me without interruption, and they are serving me with heartfelt love. They are already serving with heartfelt love, and then Krishna says, I shall give them the inspiration by which they will come to me. Mam upayanti te. Then, this is redundant. It has already been said that they are connected to Krishna. But again, how is it that again they will come to me? How is Krishna's statement they come to me to be harmonized? So I found a deeper meaning to the words mam upayanti te. I took here the word upayanti, which ordinarily means they come, to indicate upapati or paramour. So upayanti, they come to me, means they consider Krishna as upapati, as paramour. In this society, there is lawful husband or pati, and there is paramour, upapati. In Vrindavan, Krishna is not considered by the gopis as their lawfully married husband, but as master, as the lord of their hearts. So here Krishna says, I inspire those who are constantly engaged in devotional service to come to me. Which devotees does Krishna here inspire? Those who are Ramanti, the highest group of devotees. Those who are related to him in concert hood and full rasa mukhi ras. Krishna says here, I inspire them to come to me, considering me as paramara upapati. So here Krishna says, bhajanti, bhajatam pritipurvakam. This means prema, which is generally found in Madhurya Ras concerthood. So the real meaning of this verse is that Krishna inspires those who are in concerthood to come to him, seeing him as paramour upapati. And how do they come to him? He inspires them to come to him without any consideration of social and scriptural demands. And so, inspired by him from within, crossing the line of scriptural and social regulations, and even deceiving their own husbands, the gopis are united with Krishna and paramour consorthood, Parakya. This idea of going beyond all rules and regulations is told also in the 18th chapter, when Krishna says, Sarva Dharmam Parityaja. So that dharmam, sarva dharmam, means all the duties, all the regulations. Sarva dharmam parityaja, they should be rejected. They can be discarded. One need not consider all those things. If you, mam may come saranam vraja, if you surrender to me. So that idea is given in the Gita. And here also, this verse. Srila Maharaj is interpreting that upayanti as upapati, coming, crossing all other considerations, simply to come to Krishna. That is the parakya. I interpret it in that way. So Krishna's position is absolute, and he relishes more the devotion of those who can cross everything for him. And he inspires his devotees from within with the message. Externally, you have to fulfill social and scriptural demands, but my position is over and above the scriptures. My position is above whatever the social laws and scriptural laws tell you to do. I am above the Vedas and everything else. The Vedas are my instructions for ordinary people. Their instructions are meant for those who have deviated from me. Society is also under the guidance of those instructions which were given to the fallen. But my connection with everything is intrinsic. It is independent of the laws of scripture and society. I do not require recognition from anyone. My connection with everything is the constant in all equations. It can never be avoided. So you must neglect all the demands from your previous life's connections and come to me. You have no freedom to do anything else. When your devotional nature will come to demand you to come to me, you are not free. Your heart must come towards me. Also in Gita, Krishna says, Vedaischa Sarva Mameva Vedo. All the Vedas are meant to know Krishna. Once you know Krishna in the Vedas, there's no necessity of studying Veda. If all the Vedas are meant for something, what is that they are meant for? To know Krishna. Then, Vedaischa Sarva Mameva Vedo. Vedanta Kud Veda Vede Vacham. I am the writer, the compiler of the Vedas. I know what they mean. They are meant to teach you about me. Don't get caught up in the flowery words of the Vedas and think that you must strictly stick to all those rules and regulations and injunctions and so forth and so on. All the rituals, sacrifices and things like that that have to be performed. You think that is the whole of Veda, then you're missing the point. This was the position Veda Vyasa also came to. He had compiled the whole Vedic literature, Puranas and everything. And then he recognized, what is this? I have told all these things, how people can come, elevate themselves from different positions in the modes of passion, ignorance, and goodness. But still something is missing. And then he came to recognize that ultimately, all those things have a purpose. And that is to understand Krishna. And then he wrote the Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam, simply talking about Krishna and his pastimes and his devotees. What is the ultimate aim of all those other performances? And you can't know Krishna simply by doing the rules, following rules and regulations also. That is Vidimark, rules and regulations. You'll never know Krishna just by doing that, unless your heart is attracted to Krishna in love. Unless some tinge of love is awakened. And how does that happen? How does that love awaken? Anyone can tell me?
Maharaj, it is already dormant in the heart, that potential for that love. So when he comes in connection with some pure devotee of Lord, either directly or indirectly, then by the blessings of that devotee, some ignition occurs, some initiation occurs.
Yes.
And it may later fructify into pure love.
Yes. Yes. So we sing, Ye Anilo Premadana. And that's that song, Narottam Das Thakur, I think, has written that song, Ye Anilo Premadana. Premadana. Premadana means who is giving prem. Who is that person who is giving prem? That is Guru, that is Vaishnav. Prem is not something we can acquire. It is a gift. And it's given by the devotee who already has been given that gift. It awakens just like so many devotees were made by Srila Prabhupada. Now, who were these persons who Srila Prabhupada brought to this platform of loving, trying to love Krishna? Who are those persons? Myself and so many others like us. But we were wandering aimlessly in the world. And simply by the love that Srila Prabhupada had for Krishna, somehow or other we got interested in what is that? What is that that he has? And by associating with him in person or through his service or through his books and so forth and so on, through the devotees, we also develop that attachment for Krishna. Before Prabhupada, we had no idea even about Krishna, what to speak of, any prem, any even a tinge of love for Krishna. So you can see from the history of his career, preaching career, how that love was inculcated within the hearts of so many thousands of persons because of his love, like that. Otherwise, we would be living another life entirely. Even if that we were living, we may have all committed suicide by this time, having such a meaningless life. But by his mercy, then we all were attracted to, also trying to awaken some kind of attachment, some kind of interest at least, in Krishna consciousness. So prema dana, that is a gift that is given to the living entities through the pure devotee, who has also received that gift from his, from another pure devotee, his predecessor, Vaishnav. And that is all ultimately coming from Krishna, yasya prasada bhagava prasado, aham sarvasya prabhavo, like that, everything coming from him. And he gives that to the world. And Mahaprabhu came to do what? To give that. Mahavadanaya, his whole purpose was to come to give this prem, Krishna prem, without any, having any qualification. He was just giving that out. And the residents of Kali are rascals all. All are rascals in this age. No one has qualified. And yet Mahaprabhu came and simply, what was his business? Krishna prema padayate, simply to give Krishna prema without regard to whatever qualification anyone had. And we can see that practically manifest in Prabhupada's pastimes. And yeah, this is upapati, paramour devotion. The devotion of Vrindavan, Vrindavan bhajan, means paramour devotion, yenamam upayanti te. So here Krishna says that to those who are Ramanti, who are already inclined to come in connection with him in concerthood as husband and wife, he gives them special feeling and inspiration within their hearts, and they shall come to him as upapati, as paramours. Here Krishna is saying, in effect, this paramour devotion is so great that it crosses the rules of both society and scripture, it is independent of everything. Connection with me is independent of everything that you can conceive. It is most intimate and natural. It does not require any scriptural or any social sanction. You may live in society showing formal respect to scriptural and social convention, but from your inner heart of hearts, you are mine. And that is yenamam upayanti te, the special instruction or nature or insight I give to these devotees. In other words, these devotees do not allow a second pati or husband to come between them and Krishna. They cannot tolerate the interpolation of any second thing, even if it involves social laws or scriptural regulations. Their devotion is so high that all the Vedas are searching after this idea, this divine position. Asammoho charanareno jusam mahamsyam vrindavane kim api gulmalato shadinam Yadushya jam svajanam aryapatam chahitva pichur mukunda paravim suti bir vimirkyam Srimad Bhagavatam 10.47.61. Although the most exalted devotion of the gopis is only hinted at in the Vedas, I can now understand their most exalted position. Oh, when shall I take birth as a creeper in Vrindavan, so that I can take the dust of the lotus feet of the gopis upon my head? Those great souls gave up society, friendship, love, their relatives, and even the Vedic principles to take shelter of the holy lotus feet of Krishna. Here, one thing should be mentioned. Parakriya Bhav has a broader application. It does not only mean paramour devotion. This feeling of crossing scriptural and social rules for unsanctioned relationship is found not only in Madhurya Rasa or concerthood. Parakiya literally means belonging to another. Vatsalya Rasa, parental affection, and Sankhya Rasa, friendship, are also infused with the sentiments of Parakiya. This is the method of love for those who follow Raga Marga. In the case of Yashoda, Parakiya takes the following form. Yashoda says, Some people say that Krishna is not my son. They say that he is Devaki's son. This feeling enhances her heart's affection towards Krishna, for then she thinks, I could lose him at any moment. This idea draws more intense affection towards Krishna and increases the affection of her servers. In Sakya Rasa, the sentiment of Parakya is also found. Some say Krishna has come from Mathura and he may go again to Mathura. He does not belong to us. He is not exclusively our friend. This apprehension also fills the minds of the coward boys and they become anxious, thinking we may lose him at any time. So that sentiment makes friendly service towards him more intense. In this way, the whole sentiment in Vrindavan is Parakya. In the mood of servanthood, or Dasyaras also, there is some sentiment like that. Devotees feel, some say that Krishna comes from Mathura, that he is the son of Vasudeva. He is here only for a while. He is not an ordinary man like us. This idea is more or less current in Vrindavan. So Parakya is not only found in Madhurya Ras, Krishna may capture all within that sentiment. Parakya is a very special thing in Madhurya Ras. The specialty is that in Madhurya Ras, it is more objectionable both to the scriptures and to the society. But for the gopis, it is not objectionable. In Madhurya Ras, they have to cross over the directions of both the Vedas and society. They must take that great risk. In other rasas, there is only the fear that we may not have Krishna permanently. He may go away. He does not belong among us. This suspicion increases the intensity of their service, but in Madhurya Ras, they must cross the positive directions of the Veda and society. They must go against these authorities as if to take risk of committing sin. This is a special feature of Parakya and Madhurya Ras. So there is the intensity, the intensity of devotion is in its highest condition. So the inspiration towards Parakya, Yenamam Upayanti Te, that Krishna discusses here, with special reference to those who are Ramanti, who are connected to him in concerthood, is also present in all the servitors of Vrindavan. So I'll save the last verse until next time. Any other comments, question? God believers say that God caused the creation. There must have been an intelligent designer. To this, some reply, but who created God? Who designed the intelligent designer? Meaning of God is the creator. What is that creative potency that we call God? The creative potency that is obviously existing.
It means the causal, original cause, Maharaj.
Aham sarvasya prabhavo. I am the original of everything. So, who is asking what is the cause of God? They are not understanding what God is. God means who is the cause of everything. Then how you can ask what is the cause of God? You're already answering the question, who is the cause of everything, and we're saying God. Then to ask what is the cause of God, that is misunderstanding what we just answered. What is the cause of everything? God. Then to say what is the cause of God, you have missed the question. You have missed the answer. Understand? You have missed the answer already. Answer is given. God is the cause of everything. Then why are you asking what is the cause of God? There's no question of that. The meaning of God is that he is the cause of everything. You cannot further ask the question, what is the cause of God? In improper understanding of what the answer is. Now, what is God? God means that. He is the creator. God doesn't need any creator from himself. He is Svarat. Abhigya Svarat. First of all, he is a conscious being. He is a person. the Adi Purush, the first person, the original person. Now, how you can go beyond the original? If he is the original person, then there's no question of anything before him. So God is the answer to what is the cause of all things. You cannot turn that answer into another question. Otherwise, you have not understood the answer. Is it clear?
Maharaj, I want to ask one question, Maharaj.
What's that?
Maharaj, actually, when we read the life stories of many big scientists of the world, say, for example, even, this, like, Oppenheimer or Niels Bohr, so we find they have expressed many nice, sentences. For example, one of the sentences of, I think, Heisenberg is that we should respect those things about which it is very difficult to talk about. So I think it was quite meaningful sentence in that. So we are seeing in all these discussions, there are many topics which are of very high standard when compared to modern, ordinary scientific, discussions. So therefore, now the scientific brain or the, person who is of, irrational, approach, who wants to believe in, some evidences of, what to say, physical nature or physico-chemical or nature. So how to present these topics which are not possible to be presented in physico-chemical descriptions as a evident or as a, some kind of proof of, that higher reality?
You have to have some Dadami Buddha Yogam Dham. Krishna will give intelligence how to do that.
So Maharaj, now, say for example, Maharaj, we see,
like, just like when I was talking with that a Nobel laureate, George Wald, I was not talking any deep scientific principles with him. I simply said matter comes from light. I simply repeated what Prabhupada told to me, and somehow the intelligence was there in him. He had been thinking of these things, no doubt. Otherwise, how he could become convinced by just hearing that?
Yes,
ma'am. And no one can actually, to say matter comes from life to a scientist is like, like short circuit for their brain. Their brain will completely short out. In the totally other direction.
Yes,
just like I told another Nobel laureate, his name was Senjurji, Albert Senjurji. Right. I told him, I said, have you ever considered that matter? Have you considered matter come from life? You know what he did? He immediately took his right hand and put it up to his forehead, and he grasped his forehead, and he said, oh, no, that's too difficult.
Yes.
He became, like, went berserk,
Yes.
He was totally thinking in the other direction. And to say something like that, he became, his brain was exploding. Made his brain explode. No, it was like that. And George Wall was completely the other way. Yes, he was somehow. And that made sense to him.
Yes.
So, no, how does that happen? Not anything I could do. Who is prepared? Who have prepared themselves. They are ready to accept those things by Krishna's arrangement.
Yes, Maharaj.
So we don't have control over that. Now, another answer, I want to give one more thing before you continue. That is, I'm thinking that when how to answer these people who say, what is the cause of the creator of God? Then in our scripture, we say, sarva karana karanam, right? That Krishna is the cause of all causes. And my interpretation of that is that Krishna is the cause in all causes. Huh? Whatever causes, that is Krishna. Cause means necessity. Necessity. Something connects one thing to another. That's called necessity. And it must do that. We call that cause or reason. What is the reason? Because of. So that internal cause, that reason, that is Krishna. So what is the cause of cause? What is the cause of cause? You understand the question, what I'm asking here? What is the cause of cause? What is causing cause to be there? That is Krishna. And you can then to ask, what is the cause of Krishna? That is a meaningless thing. I have already answered, what is cause itself? And we consider that Krishna in our scriptures. That is given as Krishna. Sarva Karana Karana, the cause in all causes. The cause of all causes. Who is that intrinsic cause that is creating this whole idea of cause? Where is that coming from? That is Krishna. This is the answer we have to give them. Then what they can ask that question, then what is causing him? Because there is nothing beyond him who is creating that causal relation. And the very substance of that causal relationship is found in him.
But then Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada says that the activities in the spiritual world are all causeless. So why that causeless comes in the spiritual world, Maharaj?
And, well, who is the cause of all causes? He has not caused himself. Then what is his position? Then, you know, we have to come to another understanding of him. Whatever he is, that is something more than that. His fundamental nature must be something that includes that, but something must be more. If he is the origin of cause, then he himself has something more to offer than just that causal relationship. Why not? We can't eliminate that possibility from him. What is coming from him? That is only one of his potencies. But what is his real nature? Now there we have to go to other scriptures. And I told that Abhigyasvarat, that first shloka of the Srimad Bhagavatam, explaining Krishna is the Abhigyasvarat, the independent knower. That Svarat means he's independent, means he is not depending on anything, even his own prior state of existence. It does not depend on that. That means he is spontaneous, free-willed Svarat. Nothing can check him.
Maharaj, I have a question. Like, you were just mentioned that Prabhupada mentioned that matter comes from the consciousness. Okay. So that means he says that Darwin theory of evolution is wrong, and or it is in another way that consciousness is the background which drives the evolution. It's not that just a matter evolves.
Well,
what is? See, my question is,
that's a different idea. Matter doesn't have any motive force in itself. It can't move. Matter is dead. It has no ability to move itself. If we say that consciousness is the cause of the movement of matter, that's a different thing. Now, what Darwin is saying is that matter, by its own ability, moves into, it changes itself into different forms. But matter can't do that. Our idea is that matter is dead. Matter can't move by itself. You have a stone, it'll sit there.
But when you see the atom as a dead matter, but still there is a movement inside that, no, electron is moving and proton is moving, everything is moving.
That's the way we think of it. But no one has ever seen that. We say that the atom is moving. We have a picture in our mind of it, but no one has ever seen that. That's how we picture it. But we say, no, the matter is dead. Matter can't move on its own. Scientists are saying there's some movement there. That's their theory. But they can't see it. They can't prove that. There's no way they can prove that. It's too small.
No, but as far as the physics, that it's very clear that electronics revolving around the...
Anyhow, they may say so many things. They can tell you that the sun is black and they can prove it up and down, but doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. They can tell that life comes from matter also. They can say so many things. Their imagination is, Prabhupada used to say, they're very, very fertile brains. They have very fertile brains. But matter means the dead, it's not moving. If the atom is moving, it means that there must be some life there. We say, yes, atom has Paramatman inside of it. And there's an Atman and Paramatman inside the atom. So some activity is there, no doubt. But it's not from the matter. That not matter. And it's not energy. It's something more than that. It's Pada Prakriti. That is causing any movement there. And won't move by itself. That is the meaning of matter, the definition of matter.
Okay, matter means no movement, like it's static.
Dead matter. So anything which matter is... can't develop in itself. And that's Darwin's theory. Darwin's theory says that matter develops by its own initiative. It develops into different forms. And we say, no, it can't do that. But only the consciousness can develop through different forms. And the consciousness develops its own forms according to the type of consciousness it is. It will manifest itself in different material forms. It is from the evolution of consciousness that we go through different species of life. Not that the bodies evolve. Objective evolution we don't accept. That's Darwin's evolution. Subjective evolution we accept.
But my question is that the consciousness evolves, it goes through the different higher type of bodies, like from lower animal species to higher animal species. Yeah. But this another doubt is that maybe the consciousness propels that body to evolve because it requires a higher type of body. So it propels the matter.
How in one life? Let's say that one consciousness is an amoeba consciousness. Okay. Now, in that life, he is amoeba. Then he has to wait until that amoeba body dies. Then he can go to the next higher consciousness. It can take that amoeba body and become a frog. It can.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe different consciousness may not be the same consciousness. Not the same unit. Maybe some different unit of consciousness.
In the amoeba body, he has to act like amoeba. As by the laws of nature, he is forced to act like amoeba until he leaves that body. Then he can develop another consciousness and goes to the frog, let's say. But not as amoeba, he can't go into the frog. Maybe, and that happens in some cases, like in the, what do you call that? That worm, what is that called? That becomes the butterfly.
Caterpillar.
Caterpillar, it goes from one life to the next. In one lifetime, he can become a caterpillar. Then he can become a butterfly. But that is a special
metabolic change.
Yeah. It's a special circumstance. And ordinarily, you can't. Amoeba can't become a frog like that. The soul can be an amoeba in one life and a frog in another. That's another thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I completely agree what you say, but my doubt is that maybe in one life the person is an amoeba, and when he creates, when generation goes, he dies, correct? He goes to a different body, but maybe that anima evolves because the consciousness which is living in that propels that amoeba to become another species in the future,
because it doesn't happen like that, because amoeba is there. Even the frog is there, the amoeba is there. All the forms of life are there. They're simultaneously. If one became another, then the other first one would die. It would not be there anymore. But it doesn't happen like that. Right?
All the amoebas would develop into some other species.
No, they don't. Right? Prabhupada told that there are different apartments. Like, you have to think like this. There are different apartments. Some small apartments, some big apartments. They're already there. But you can go from one apartment to the other. Not that the apartments evolve.
I think they call this speciation or how...
Speciation. That's Darwin's theory, but it doesn't. That we don't accept that. In Veda, we can't find any indication of that happening.
Genetically, they made some experiments, and genetically some part of the, I don't know which species they experimented, I forgot, but some of the part of the species they genetically changed. They made some experiments with birds and I don't know which species.
But the thing is, they
could not anymore communicate between themselves. So they say these two different species were created. There was no animal communication. They genetically changed and like that. So in the future, they would even change more.
They can say so many things like that, but it's not how it happens. We don't. It's not that they. If you change the genetic code in an amoeba, for instance, you may be able to get some different types of amoeba, but they're all amoebas. Doesn't change into a giraffe. It won't happen like that, or a frog. Nothing.
Okay.
It won't happen like that. They'll become different types of amoebas only. But that we can say that we call that adaptability. That is not transmutation. That is not evolution. That is the adaptability. And certainly, we have a lot of range of adaptability in us. Just like you can come from India to the United States, and you can adapt. You may be used to a warm climate. Here you have to get used to cold climate. Some adaptive ability is there in us. But not that you can change from a human being to something other, or an animal to a human being.
I think
Maharaj, there is one. Okay.
Within this, biological evolution theory itself, Maharaj, I think there are some very difficult questions which are confronting them also. For example, one of the questions is why all the amino acids are liver rotatory, and why they are not dextro rotatory within the biological systems. Because if it was a chance process or a chance, was correct, then they should be having 50% of both of them. But living beings are predominantly liver, and there is no rational explanation for that until now.
Then, not only are the aminos liver, but the sugars are dextro. All the sugars are dextrose, rotary. The amino acids are liver rotary, and the sugars are dextro rotary. Why?
But in one particular Upanishad, I don't remember what it is. I heard that Yajnavalkya speaking to Garga Muni about evolution of matter. Like he's talking about this earth is woven by water and fire, and water is woven by gas and fire, and it keeps on going, and finally he says everything comes from Brahman. So it looks like from the Brahman all this matter evolved.
That's a different thing. That is the matter. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego, they all come. Yes, they are all different transmutations of the pradhan. The unmanifested stage of pradhan, they manifest in different from different levels of transmutation of one another. That's there. But that is matter, material principles. Those are the material principles. That the material principles all ultimately, they come from one principle, that we admit. But that has nothing to do with the different forms of life. Form, you see, there are two things. There's matter and there's form.
Okay.
Material principle and the formal principle. So the form is something else. Form doesn't come from the material evolution. Form is something that requires some intelligence, and therefore presence of the interaction of the soul with the material elements is necessary to get the different forms.
Maharaj, some religious people are inclined to think, because they are accepting evolution as a fact, because of the, I think, strong influence of the science, they accept evolution, and because they are religious, they also say that actually that whole evolution happened under the guidance of God. That is called that guided evolution. So what you would say about that? Guided evolution. Mm-hmm. There is evolution, but it is under the control of God.
By God's control.
I think I would not agree with this concept.
Yes, again, according to the way our philosophy is stating, the way our philosophy presents the formation of the material world, in the Gita, it talks about the banyan tree, you know, that there is a banyan tree and that the roots are growing up and the leaves are growing down. And that means that this world is the perverted reflection of the spiritual world. So, like, for instance, now, if we think that the form of a cow, how the form of a cow came about, we think that by some combination of chemicals, by some evolution of an amoeba, a cow, the form of a cow had come out of that. How is it possible? No, our idea is not like that. A cow has a form, as it has in this material world, because there is a cow in the spiritual world. And this cow in this world is the perverted reflection of that cow in the spiritual world. We have trees here because there are trees there. We have humans here because there are humans there. So these forms that we are experiencing in this world have their spiritual counterparts. And that's where they're coming from. And if we study the great philosophers like Plato, for instance, he also talked of the world of ideas, the ideal world, he called it. That world is there, and that's how this is where all these ideas are coming from. Cow is an idea, tree is an idea. All these are things are ideas. Otherwise, how does a scientist explain what they are? From an atom, you can't explain a tree. From the atom's point of view, when you explain everything in terms of atoms, molecules, you have not even colors. All you have is atoms and molecules. What atoms and molecules in one form? How did they become called a tree? How did another one become called another arrangement called a cow? Where do those names come from? Where do those ideas come from if it's all just atoms? From an atom point of view, everything is identical.
I appreciate this idea, but it seems to me that still the manifestation of those forms from the spiritual world, how they were manifested in this material world, by this explanation you give, it is not explained.
Well, that's another thing. Like I said, we have to go deeper into the philosophy to understand what is the connection between the ideas and the instances. There we have to look at the structure of reason. What is the structure by which we reason, by which we understand things, by which we perceive things? These things were studied by philosophers like Kant and Hegel and Plato and Aristotle. They intricately delve with these problems of what is the relation between, they call it universal, particular, and individual. The universal is like the concept, the idea. The particular is like the what is that individual made of? What is that thing that we are dealing with made of? That's called the particular. And then what is that form that it takes, that the individual takes? Just like you say, animal. You go into forest, look for animal. You won't find any animal in the forest. You'll find tigers. You'll find bears. You'll find lions. But animal you won't find. And yet they are all animals. Right? So animal is called the universal. It can't be seen in this world. But the particular species, lion, we can find that. And then beyond the species, there's the particular specimen itself, the thing that we actually touch and see and feel. So in philosophy, these are called universal, particular, and individual. And there's a relationship, there's a logical relationship between these things. And how that develops through dialectic is a very great science, but it requires a lot of study. And you want to understand those things, you will have to apply your brain very diligently to understand all those things. But it has been done. It has been done by all these great philosophers. It's not that it's not there, but people don't study that. They think they can explain everything in terms of atoms, and they're forgetting the important questions. They don't know how to relate those atoms, why there are clouds, why there are trees, why there are people. They can't answer those questions. Huh? Einstein once told, you can't analyze Beethoven's symphony in terms of the compression and refraction of the air. Music is sound. The scientists can measure the compression of the air and the rarefaction and the expansion of the air. But from that analysis, they can't tell anything about the song. They can't even tell that there's a song. I give the example, you take a book and you analyze it chemically and physically. Now that'll tell you anything about what the book is about. Even you analyze the letters in the book. How many A's, how many B's, how many that, like this, how many that. Will that tell you anything? That kind of analysis at that level is not appropriate for what it is that you have to describe. It's not appropriate. Does not cover the phenomenon that we are really dealing with. It doesn't cover it. It's not sufficient.
In some critical journals, Maharaj, dealing with the question of origin of life. So they are, they are admitting actually in their discussions that we have not been able to explain life, but we admit that, we have a full hope that we will be ultimately be able to explain life in terms of physics and chemistry alone. This is what they say, Maharaj. But they are admitting that we have not been able to do. But the only way it is possible. Will be that because between say the mother and the cell and the daughter cells, only thing common is the nuclei. So they think the secret of life is in the nuclei or in the DNA molecule or RNA molecule. I think this is the ultimate thing. So if they can prove this, that life exists in DNA and RNA, then only I think they can discuss the other matters like evolution theory and so many other topics.
That's another thing. Trying like that, showing that the DNA, that according to the current neo-Darwinian evolution theory, then the DNA is a very important part in that. But now they're finding also that this DNA theory is called the dogma, central dogma in biology. This whole idea that DNA creates proteins, they're finding that's also breaking down. And the cellular system is so complicated. You can't say that the DNA is creating the proteins any more than you can say that the proteins are creating the DNA. Yes. Because both are going on. They're both going on simultaneously. Which one came first, which came second, they can't tell. Just like chicken egg problem. They can't really tell. But they have made it as their dogma. They call it the central dogma of biology, that proteins are made from DNA. And they have a whole process for that. But that is all dogma, dogmatically stated, assumed. That was made by Watson and Crick, who discovered DNA. They came up with that central dogma of biology.
RNA is synthesized by RNA, but then the problem is where did the first RNA come from?
Yeah, that's another thing. But that is also, like I'm telling, they are simply making a stand that DNA produces protein.
Chicken egg problem.
In the living cell, it is known a fact that the protein produces the DNA also. How the protein is, what kind of protein is there, will determine what type of DNA it is. It's not simply a one-way process. It's a two-way process. And so to arbitrarily state that the DNA produces the protein, This is merely picking something out of the sky. It cannot be verified in any experimental way. It's merely a theoretical ruse, a theoretical crutch that they use for explaining things. But in real life, there's no reason to say one way or the other.
So, Maharaj, this tangled hierarchy. This tangled hierarchy means say RNA first or DNA first. So I think in many phenomena of life also we see that, for example, a love between the mother and child. So whether the love of the mother on the child is due to that she is his mother or the child loves the mother because she is the child. So I think from where we started. So this question cannot be answered in this way, Maharaj, I think. So I think this tangled hierarchy is being faced in many problems of modern science. and so they cannot find ultimate cause for that. Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Yes, so anyhow, it's not so difficult problem if we look at the assumptions they are making. We can see that there are certain things they're trying to make a very simplified picture, but the picture is not so simplified as they're making it, and they can't explain so many things. That's the point. It seems like they're explaining so much, but actually they're explaining nothing. Explain nothing about the reality we actually experience.
Yes, Maharaj.
Simply a bunch of
proposals.
Proposals or whatever, as unreal. A bunch of imaginary things. Srila Maharaj used to call it fairy tales. They are telling so many fairy tales, and people are believing those fairy tales, that they are the true, the real thing. Mythology. They have their own mythology, and people are accepting that scientific mythology as the reality. I know. We deal with chairs and tables and trees and houses and people. Where do you find that in quantum chemistry or chemistry or physics? Where are the people? Where are the roses?
Yes.
See, they have no ability to describe those things. None. And they don't know how to get to that level from their
adults. Most of the life they are spending in laboratories, Maharaj, under the microscope.
Whatever. They don't. No, that's not a fact. They have their wives, they have their children, they have their houses, they have their cars. Right? They have to deal with the real world. And they go off into the laboratories and go into this fairyland. And they think that, then they come and tell us, look, oh, we're telling the truth. We're giving the reality. Where? How do you make a car with? How do you get into your car from your atomic calculations? How do you drive your car with your atomic calculations? How do you feed yourself with your atomic calculations? They're getting money from people who believe their fairy tales, that's all. And that's how they're making their living.
How can you, Maharaj, prove by philosophy that the spiritual forms became manifested on material plane?
How to prove when? How? By chemical
how
means?
How to prove by philosophy? No, how to prove by
philosophy.
That the...
I can't tell you things that will require years for you to study. You pick up a book on Hegel and you study. Go ahead.
No, I want some Vedic stuff.
If you want to understand from a Western perspective how all those things are related, you'll have to read some Western philosophers. Vedic philosophers, we have to accept what they're telling us. Sankhya is there. It explains somehow those things. But in a way that is a little difficult for us to understand because we're not trained in that idiom. We're not trained in the Vedic idiom. We're only trained in the Western way, at least I am. Who has studied in those deep thoughts of the Vedas, they may be able to explain these things. They may know these things. But if they try to explain to us, we may not be able to understand what they're saying either because we don't have that kind of background. It takes years of study to understand those deep things. I only barely understand them from a Western point of view. Still, I am working how to make that clear and how to present that. But it's there. It's not that people have not thought of these things, of course. We're not the first to think about these problems. Thousands of years have gone by. People are thinking of these things. This atomic theory is not something new. In the ancient days, Democritus in the Western world, Vaisheshika philosophy is there.
Kannada. Kannad Maharaj.
Kannada. Vaisheshika is also atomic, no?
Yes, Maharaj.
I think so. Yes.
Yes, yes. Kannad. This philosophy of Kannad. Kannad means atom. Means atom.
I see. Anyhow, is there a long time they have thought of these things? It's not that we're the first ones. And they have had to deal with all these problems. How to bring that kind of understanding to the realistic platform. So, all right.
Thank you very much, Maharaj.
We are going from the high. We are going from the highest things to the atomic things. Parakia, parakia to the proton. Oh, very good. All right, you're giving me a.
Thank you so much, Maharaj.
Thank you.
Giving me a workout today. All right, thank you. Thank
great
you.
Blessings and great mercy that you know we are.
Hare Krishna. All right, my humble dandava pranam. Jai Shri Prabhupada, Jai Shri Shri Prabhupada, Jai Guru Vrindaki Jai. Ribo, Ribo.
Hare Krishna, Dandavat Maharaj.
Dhanyavad Sarvana, nice to have you again. We haven't seen you in a long time.
No, I'm trying every Sunday to attend class. But okay. Last time I went to my native place, so I could.
I see. All right. My humble Dhanyavad to you.
Dhanyavad Maharaj.
Dhanyavad Pranash.
Dhanyavad. Dhanyavad Sakshaya Prabhu.
Dhanyavad Maharaj.